Okay. So welcome everybody in Cape Town for this afternoon session with myself and Joseph Harden. That's for the benefit of the people listening on audio. I'm going to talk a little bit about the future, what do I want to call it? The future of e-learning, the future of learning objects, the future of learning resources. I'll just call it future of learning resources. Online learning is characterized typically by the concept of a learning object, and the concept of a learning object is typically characterized as the concept of the reusable digital content or reusable digital media for education. The idea being that these things are discoverable, interoperable, and modular, so that a person in the process of creating a course, and here I'm talking about traditional educational institutions, can assemble them together, or as the saying goes, plug them in together like Legos and build a course like you would a brick wall. That didn't work. And if you dispute that, we'll talk about that in the discussion. So I've done a lot of work on learning objects. Now you're supposed to laugh. Okay, I've tried that 3 times. I laughed the first time, second time, third time, nothing. I've learned my lesson. I've worked on learning objects for a long time, and I don't believe the concept is dead. But I believe that the way we've instituted or worked with the concept is dead. And what I believe is dead specifically is this idea of trying to build the education into the learning resource or into the learning management system. In other words, to try to make these educational resources. I think that the effort to create educational resources as opposed to resources was misplaced. And the reason for that is, when you try to make something an educational resource, you're creating it to apply to a very specific context. But if you create it to apply to a specific context, then it's no longer reusable. You can only apply it in one place. And it has to be exactly the kind of place that you had in mind. And my belief is, and this is where we'll get into discussions with Sakai. That wasn't anything Freudian. It's just I've been calling it Saki for so long, and then finally I just said in a jest once, I'm just saying Saki, and I was just sort of, it's probably pronounced Sakai as a joke, and it turns out it is.
Well, it depends on where you are.
Yeah.
In Japan, it's Sakai.
Sakai, okay. But again, with the creation of educational software, like learning management systems, again, the effort is to put the education almost into the system. There's the talk, and of course, they used to talk, Murray Goldberg and WebCT, the technology is pedagogically neutral, but it's not pedagogically neutral. And the more full-featured these systems become, the more non-neutral they become, the more they steer you into a certain direction. So WebCT/Blackboard/BlackWeb/WeelSueEveryone forces you into a training manual serial learning kind of approach. SCORM ADL forces you into military lockstep precision study on your own approach. Even Moodle, which is very open, forces you into a constructivist approach. They wouldn't say they force you into a constructivist approach. They'd say they enable a constructivist approach. But it's a point of view. The idea that you can just plug course components together and build a course the way you can build a brick wall doesn't work. You cannot simply create these objects and smart software and fling it all together and say, lo and behold, here is learning. It doesn't work that way. We have to refocus on the problem that we're trying to solve. And the problem But those of us who got into online learning in the early to mid 90s was a problem not of how do we build cool software and things like that, but it was a problem of access. I got my feet wet in online learning in rural Manitoba, in northern Alberta, in the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s. And the problem we were trying to solve with this is how do you get learning to a person who lives on a farm 20 miles away from the nearest community and 500 miles away from the university? How do you get learning in a way that's accessible to people in such a way that they don't have to quit their job? How do you get learning to people, to women especially, who are at home, who are caring for their children and are not able to get out of the house? Those were the problems we were trying to solve. We weren't trying to, the quality e-learning and all of that. We weren't up to corporate e-learning and staff management solutions. We certainly weren't, military, you learn on the boat kind of thing. We were trying to get education out into our communities. And for the most part, all of Canada's e-learning has developed that way. And it gives us a very different approach. And Scott Leslie, working in British Columbia, doing the same sort of thing. Myself, George Siemens, who's in Manitoba. Darcy Norman in Calgary, trying to work with distance learning throughout Alberta. Harold Jarchi down the road from me in New Brunswick, rural New Brunswick. All of Canadians are working on it that way. Norm Friesen. What does work? Now, Norm Friesen, again, Athabasca University and now in British Columbia, an authority on learning objects, says what works is simplicity. Make it simple as opposed to really big enterprise systems. That was a dig at you. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. Make it simple. Make it an audio file, an image, something you just fling around. Make it RSS, which has three metadata elements instead of learning object metadata, which has 87 or whatever. I lose count. Compatibility. Make it something you can use with your web browser or your email. The IMS content packaging specification includes, after you've done all your packaging, you zip the thing, thereby making it impossible to use on your browser without a learning management system. Who was thinking about that? And it should be a relative advantage. You don't just try to do what you were doing. You don't just try to do the classroom except online. You try to do what you were doing better, more accessible, more open, more useful. So what we needed was learning resources, easily labeled, easily accessible, simple, and usable in such a way that we could rapidly and easily get at them and begin using them without a whole investment in some sort of software solution. Brian Lamb, Darcy Norman, and Alan Levine went on a series of talks about the use of RSS in learning. RSS is a concept behind the syndication of learning objects. RSS is simple metadata, right? Metadata is just XML like this to describe a resource. An RSS is XML that consists of two essential fields and an optional one. The essential field, the title, so you have something to click on, and the link, so you have something to go to. And then the optional field is a description. Title, link, description. Very simple. Simple metadata. Simple description of learning resources. You don't try to tell people how to describe the resource. People come up with their own way of describing the resource. RSS works like this. If you produce a resource, you have your resource here. It was originally for news items, like a column in a newspaper. You put them on your server. And then you put your RSS file on your server as well. And that's here. It's like an index to the content that you have available. Somebody called an aggregator or a harvester will go to your website and retrieve the RSS. Think of it as like Google. You know how Google will go to your website and bring stuff in order to provide a search engine. Well, these aggregators do the same thing, except they do it for RSS files and not for all web files. So now there's a whole index in the aggregator of not just your resources, but a whole bunch of people's resources. And then somebody else, a student, a teacher, somebody who's just interested in stuff, comes along, they search in the index, and they receive the results of that search in yet another RSS feed. If they find something in that RSS feed that they liked, they retrieve it from the original source and then display it. Does this system work? Well, how many of you have heard of blogs? This is the system that makes blogging work. All right? You write your blog post. Blogger, or whatever software you're doing, automatically creates this file. A service like BlogLines, or any of these online sites that you can go to read blog files, automatically retrieves this, and then you log on, you get your list of all the new articles, all the new blogs that were published recently, you click on the link, and you read somebody's blog post. Exactly the same system. Does it work? Yes. Is it, you know, adopted? Has it been adopted? 30, 40, 50 million blogs, we've lost count. Not, that doesn't include MySpace, which has 86 million accounts, which are also RSS-enabled. That doesn't include Flickr, which has millions of photographs available that you can use for free, which are also RSS-enabled. My question is, why would you use a learning management system when, through an RSS aggregator and a browser, you can access hundreds of millions of learning resources for free? Lots of examples of this stuff in action. I've built some of them. Am I online?
Should be.
Let's find it. Nope. Cannot locate the internet server or proxy server. Don't worry about it. I only have 25 minutes. We'll come back to that this afternoon. EduRSS harvests the combined writings of about 350 writers in educational technology, brings them all together, puts them out as a web page. If I clicked on that link, I would get the stuff that was written about e-learning in the last half hour. Imagine you're a learner. Imagine your field of study is e-learning. What kind of resource that is? Who needs a course when you've got everything that's being published in the field constantly up to date? And that means the advanced stuff, the simple stuff, and everything in between. And you, the learner, pick and choose what you're going to follow up. A lot of talk about what learning is, where the learning is in a learning resource. You have a picture, or you have here's a learning resource, right? And where is the learning? This may be a bad example because it's a computer. Here's a learning resource. Where is the learning in this resource? Where are the learning objectives? Where is the assessment? Where's the exam in this learning resource? And the answer, of course, is not in this resource at all. The learning in a learning resource lies in how the resource is used, not how the resource is designed. And that's the fundamental difference between e-learning 2.0 and traditional learning management system-based learning. The learning is in the use, not the design. All kinds of examples of use. Workplace supports, communities of practice, multimedia. I tell a story from time to time about the fishing rod. Now you finally hear my fishing rod story, and I'll keep it brief because I've probably got about 30 seconds left. You've all heard of fishing, right? I've learned not to assume. So you're out there, right? You're at the river or at the lake, and you've got your brand new fishing rod. Beautiful, still gleaming, chromium. It's one of these fly fishing rods. You have to cast it. You go to the shore, and you cast your fishing rod, and the thing goes, blub, 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 plunk. you know, line's about 5 feet in front of you. And your fishing rod says, you've never fished before, have you? And you start to look around. And then you realize it's your fishing rod that has spoken to you. And so you figure, well, when a fishing rod speaks to you, you reply, no, I haven't fished before. And the fishing rod says, would you like me to teach you? And you say, you still don't really know what's going on. Sure. And the fishing rod gives you a quick 30-second lesson. Because what the fishing, as soon as you said sure, the fishing rod has contacted your personal information system that you're just wearing as an RFID chip in your shirt. And so the fishing rod now knows that you are not going to listen to anything that's longer than 30 seconds. Because that's the way you are. So it gives you about 30 seconds worth of instruction. And then it says, now try it. And you try again. And then the fishing rod says, that was much better. Because the fishing rod remembers. Right, and it knows how far the line has gone out. Right, it knows the arc that you did because it got a little gyroscope, a little tiny gyroscope, and a mini gyroscope, and so it senses how you've done the fishing. And so through the afternoon, you were just having a nice quiet day fishing. It just sort of gently helps you fish better. And you know, over time, your fishing rod introduces you to communities of people near you who also like to fish. It introduces you to some fish recognition books, and because it discovers you're interested in birds, also some bird recognition books, and so on. You see the picture? Right? And that's, if you have a mechanism roughly similar to RSS, and if you have something sufficiently intelligent like your fishing rod can pull in the resources to offer learning on the fly, or on the fly fishing, if you will. Sorry. I couldn't resist. And the learning occurs in the use of the resource, in context, at the side of the river or the lake. Enter Web 2.0. How do you make a system like this work? You need a whack of materials. All kinds of stuff. You need blog posts, you need photographs, you need audio, you need video, any sort of resources that you can think of. Created, made freely accessible through the network, which you would do by licensing them as Creative Commons or something equivalent. I say something equivalent because there will be successors through Creative Commons, expressed in open digital rights language, for example. And these are available. You need these things to be syndicated through RSS or something similar so that your fishing rod or whatever system you're using can find them. So we get people creating things. Who creates things? Publishers? No.
Do they charge you money?
Instructors? Professors? No. They're the most expensive people going around. You don't want them building stuff. You want them in a classroom or teaching people directly, personally. Right? No, the people who should be making these learning resources are the learners. Why not? First of all, they're cheap. You don't have to pay them. Okay, I'm just kidding. The main reason is, in the creation of a learning resource, you have one of the best ways of learning. Because the creation of something involves yourself in a learning process. If you simply listen to a talk, you hear, but if you listen to the talk, take notes, etc., now that same content is going through your mind in two different ways. And I'm not going to give you that pyramid of stuff, but the whole idea here is that as you repeat the experience of exposure to the content in different forms, that reinforces the learning. So creating and manipulating learning resources is a good way for learners to learn. And the other thing is, they're going to do it anyways. They're going to take pictures. We know this because they populated Flickr with millions of photographs. That's in the first 2 or 3 years of Flickr, right? We have millions of photographs now. 10 years from now, 5 years from now, how many? A trillion photographs? You need a photograph of a rhinoceros? You can pick, you will be able to pick not only the type of rhinoceros. I learned last week there's white rhinos and black rhinos. I never knew that before. Where the rhinoceros was from, what scenery's in the background, and only rhinos that are named Fred. Well, because there's a trillion images. I mean, it probably won't be quite up to a trillion in 5 years. I'd say 200-300 million. It's not that fast. Audio files, again, upload. Video, this was the era of YouTube. And I tested, when I was in Bloemfontein, I tested on ordinary internet access, the 3G, the Vodacom 3G. YouTube videos work. They work well enough. They work excellent. They work beautifully. It worked just as well as it works sitting on my desktop at home. YouTube videos. So videos can be used here in Africa, at least with the 3G. I don't know about other access because that's all I have. Normally in a talk like this, I go to each one of these, but this, again, this is a learning resource. PowerPoint slide. I will post these learning resources on my website, downs.ca, and then you can access this later on. You can follow all these things up, and if you want, you can take any of the text, any of the images, etc., from my slideshow and do whatever you want with them. You can record this talk. You can videotape this talk and do anything you want with it. You can take a photograph of me doing this talk and draw a little false mustache on it. Go for it. I mean, that's the idea, right? Get the resource out there and have people create new things with that resource. And that's where the learning happens, in that recreation, that recombining, that remixing. Collaborative writing, because you don't have to do this all by yourself. The wiki is a type of content that's written by many people all in the same environment. One person writes it, another person comes along and edits it. Another person comes along and edits that. There is a copy of the South African curriculum on a wiki. If you click on that link, you'll go to it. It's not official, but it is the South African curriculum, and it is on a wiki. So if you think it should be changed, go in there. It won't change it, really, because the government doesn't use a wiki to govern. Well, one wonders whether they shouldn't. Yeah, rightly, two or more people can work on the same Word document at the same time. You're both creating the document at the same time. You type, somebody else types, you see their typing, you see your typing. It all happens at once. Aggregators that I talked about, EduRSS, Intutes is a new aggregator for learning resources that was recently launched in Britain. It's the new face, as they say, of the resource discovery network in Britain. It is a learning object repository or collection of learning resources done properly, because it's based on aggregation, bringing in these resources, or bringing in, more accurately, the index of these resources. Where we're going with all of this is something called the personal learning environment. Right now, your learning environment, if you are a learner and learning online, your learning environment belongs to the university. Think about it. You have to use your browser, you log in, sakai.kcon.cpu or whatever, or blackweb.utoronto.ca or whatever. You're logging into their learning management system. So right away, you are alienated from your learning. Right away, you have no control over your learning. It's all in their hands. Right away, you have been put into a box created by a provider, never to emerge from that box again. Well, okay, maybe that's an exaggeration, but you know what I mean. The personal learning environment turns that upside down. The personal learning environment is yours. It resides on your website or on a provider that you have picked, or on one of these. Why not? You can run Firefox and a whole bunch of stuff on one of these. You go to any computer anywhere in the world, pop that in the side, your personal learning environment pops up. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter where it is, because it's yours. Your personal learning environment is kind of like an aggregator, kind of like a blogging tool. It brings in content from multiple suppliers. It allows you to remix and reformat that content and then it allows you to syndicate that content, to send it to Blogger or to Flickr or to YouTube or Google Video or wherever you want to send it. It creates a new model of learning. It moves us from the old, all in a line, to the new network type of model. Here's the picture, and there's a bunch of people all over the world working on this now. This will be the successor to the learning management system. Future VLE, that's your learning, your personal learning environment that you have and you access. These are all the external resources, commercial and non-commercial. You pick what resources you're going to use. If you want to use Flickr, you use Flickr. If you don't want to use Flickr, you don't use Flickr. Nobody tells you you must use Flickr. There's already some discussion, some talk about the study stick that I just mentioned. There's an early diagram of some of this stuff. You know, it's our tradition, right? Like, we draw a diagram of the personal learning environment on a whiteboard, that becomes a learning resource. And just drag it, well, in this case, I dragged it and dropped it into a PowerPoint file. Why not? This is my contribution. It's not very good, but it works. And I would link to it right now if I was online. You pick your content sources, any RSS feed, a combination of RSS feeds, which I called MyGlue, which is another service, Flickr, Wikipedia, Google, whatever your sources in, whatever your sources are. Your listings come up here. This is the index of stuff that you have aggregated that you're looking for. You can drag and drop into this writing area. Right now, this is just a plain text writing area, but it could be anything, right? There's no reason why it has to be text. It could be a whiteboard, whatever. And then once you finish doing your thing, and you can't see it because it's hidden underneath here, then you send it to your Blogger account or to Flickr or whatever. This works now. This is what kills me. To make this, an afternoon. It took me an afternoon to build this. And it works. Now, I still don't, you know, still displays your password. And it doesn't have all the content sources I would like, but it took me an afternoon to build this. I figure that a team of 100 programmers working for a month could probably improve on it. But, you know, but the skeptical side of me says, the more people that get involved in, the more importantly, the more management there is of this project, the worse and worse it will get. But I'm a bit of a skeptic. I hope I'm not over my 25 minutes, but that's my 25 minutes.
You are, and it's worth it. Thank you. Okay, and I'm sure there will be a lot of perspectives which may be very different when we hear from Joseph Hart.
Can I stick this in there?
Go right for it. You know, the silliest thing that you have to push this button and go through this to remove your removable hardware. It's like Microsoft never figured that you would want to remove your removable hardware.
Pull it out, it looks dangerous.
But it's these guys doing the thinking for you, you know? They won't let you decide for yourself. Let's try it now.
Danger, danger.
Yeah. I made Bill Gates mad. Oh no.
He's gonna get me now.
They did his friends at Blackboard.
I asked earlier today how many people here were familiar with the Blackboard patent issue. How many people are? So about a third of you aren't getting half of these references to Blackboard and I'll sue anybody that moves, right? I'll talk about that just a little bit when I get into this, as soon as I can find my stick. Yeah. Let's see, it's going to be up under my computer, no doubt. somewhere there's a local disk. Where's the rest?
The removable drivers are being recognized as a control panel and admin.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Just came on.
Okay, just came on?
Just found it.
There we go. Travel drive.
Because it takes 2 minutes.
So let's find this. This is a remixed bit that has something from some earlier talks and one that I just gave a few days ago that has to do with crossing over, taking content from educational institutions and learning management systems, what we call collaboration and learning environments, and putting them into open educational resource environments. And I'll talk a little bit about that. I've got like a totally different starting point, so let's just rewind and start over. I'll talk about some of the things that Stephen mentioned. But on the plane coming down here from Johannesburg, I gave this some, you know, crazy title, Futures in Education, Building a Global Commons for the Range of Scholarly Activities. I'll talk a little bit, of course, about Sakai, but more about the ideas behind it and why it's a system that we think is, or not we think, but a system that was built in order to support people who teach in institutions, people who learn in such institutions, and the convergence that I'm seeing between the practices in those organizations, like the University of Michigan, and the kind of online learning that Stephen was talking about. So that's where I started. I said, okay, let's see. There's convergence going on between self-learner and online communities of learning and communities of learning in institutions. And just take that and run with it. These are horrible slides. There's way too much printing on them, of course, because they were trying to capture some ideas. And the idea here is that we'll just use these as places to start off and ways to remind myself of what's going on. So the processes of mentoring students in our major educational institutions are being exposed to all of the kind of online tools and practices that are emerging from the online self-learner environment, and through systems like Sakai or WebCT or Moodle or A-Tutor, or you can pick the institution's system. A lot of these were homegrown in the last 6 or 7 years to support traditional classrooms and support them through online activities, sort of hybrid systems. All these are exposing more and more faculty at institutions of learning, especially higher education institutions, to the kinds of tools that are that were described by Stephen. Right? This is opening up traditional schools and sensitizing their faculty to the values of open online activities. And I mean this not just as exposure to technology, but more a recognition that the values of the academy, of openness, of publication, of public criticism, of providing for a commons and building a commons, are also realized in the tools and in the practices of places like Wikipedias, or for that matter, and more to the point, the open courseware work that was done at MIT and that's being done now in more places, and that I'll talk about as this goes on. Institutions and faculty and institutions are learning from all this, and one of the things they're learning is that there is a similarity in value systems, and there are internal values that can be realized through opening up their teaching to these kinds of educational systems and educational practices. So I said here, use and adoption at an institutional level, these are now critical infrastructure. If our system goes down, if the online system at the University of Michigan goes down, the whole place freaks out. Everybody starts calling me, or now not this year, not me, but the guy who now has to take those calls. This is now understood as a part and parcel, a central component of teaching at the University of Michigan. So this is generating some new practices in our institutions and showing the critical value of mentoring again. The open courseware system at MIT was essentially, I don't know, 2001, 2002, Chuck Vest said, I'm going to give away all the course materials at MIT. And a bunch of people said, you're nuts. A bunch of people said, this is visionary. And he said, one of the things that I'm showing to my faculty is, A, they should be talking to the other faculty. And this is one route to get them to do that. And it's turned out that that's been the case. And B, that I can give away all of my lecture materials, all of my reading materials, all of the class lists, everything that goes up to make up an MIT education, and if you don't come to MIT, you still won't get that MIT education. Because the value of MIT is in the interaction between the faculty and the students and between the students themselves. So that, I think, is a critical thing for faculty at any institution to pick up on. And that is that in this world, a lot of that material, much of the material, is available online. It's available in an open environment, and that's a good thing. The more that we can build that, the more that we can contribute to that, the more we can build on that, the better it is. And the value of our work as faculty is still critical, right? It's central to education, and it's central to that learning and that learning experience of mentoring. That's one of the things that some people don't recognize when they look at something like OpenCourseWare. They think this is just people giving away courseware. No, it's refocusing the faculty onto the tasks of mentoring, right, in institutions. And by the way, I think that there will always be significant value. It'll always be critical for there to be places where people can go and geographically get together and work in a common culture and have that face-to-face interaction that allows for this huge high bandwidth exchange of information and work with others and have the mentor in that situation. Right? There's no concern on my part, as there was at certain points during the .com, not on my part, but on a lot of people's part, that bricks and mortar institutions were somehow obsolete, right? They're not, right? What we're going to see is a hybridization of those institutions with the kinds of technologies and practices that are emerging from the net, and the net's going to provide the thing that's provided for everybody, right? Communication at essentially a zero cost. And it will create new things. It will create, as Steven Weber says, new modes of production. And if you're an old Marxist, that's a big phrase, right? Now, new mode of production is more than just a new way of doing business. It's a way that affects all the relationships up and down the chain of producer, consumer, worker, owner, all of those things. And open source software is one of those things. Right? The idea that we could create a complex artifact of this size and with this functionality of this complexity in a totally distributed environment like this. 10 years ago, people did say, in fact, even now, people still say it's crazy. Right? It's nuts. How could you produce something that a multi-billion dollar corporation like Microsoft or like IBM, when they tried to do it, or others, these are organizations that are not dumb. They know how to do software development. There are values in concentrated teams of software developers, even on large projects. But how could you possibly get a group of people who are essentially volunteering their activities, in many cases, though not completely, and there's a hybridization there that goes on, and develop an artifact in software that is just as good, if not better, and in fact has some properties that make it better, period. If you want to go to the, if we want to get into arguments along this line, we can say, we can take a position, open source software, in every case, will provide you with a better product than a proprietary piece of software that's focused on exactly the same activity, right? You can make that argument. I don't have to hear that. Okay, so this convergence is increasingly generating more and more educational resources. Now, I don't think that those resources that are developed by those faculty and the students that are working with those faculty in those classes should be discounted. I don't think they should be thrown away. I don't think that all educational resources should be created by the learners. I think that this, again, is a hybrid situation. This is one in which collaboration between educators and learners, mentors and students, can develop extremely valuable resources. And in some cases, I would prefer to have material that was developed by an experienced mentor. Right? So, a lot of these are being generated in these systems that are now part of the critical infrastructure at increasingly large numbers of universities. And one of the questions is, how do we get those out? Right? What is a way of getting these constantly updated and diverse resources that are in context for a learning experience in the places that they were created? Necessarily one that's not totally universal. I think that the whole learning object thing, I think Stephen's right on target with that. I never went after a learning object model when I was thinking about working with something like Sakai or with other collaboration systems. My background's more collaboration in general. I come out of sociology, as much if not more than CES and places like that. I'm at the School of Information, which means I, you know, ask me any question. But that kind of thing, that kind of resource, those kinds of developed materials, I think are very valuable. Again, the open courseware experience at MIT leads us to believe that as the use of those grows exponentially and the number of sites, number of times that sites hit from places outside the United States grows in the same fashion. But I'll just take it as a given, right? So what I'm going to argue is that we're watching right now the emergence of structures to support and protect open source, community source, and open educational resources on a global scale. These kinds of resources, which I'll talk about more a little bit more later. Somebody's got to tell me, by the way, when I've got 10 minutes left, right? Because then I'll, or you know, give me some idea, because I have none. But there's been enough time zone changes that my clock has just given up. Right? Because it's not like I'm off or feel goofy about something. Though if I say anything silly, we can blame it on the jet lag. But generally, I just don't have a clock anymore. Okay. So, one example of this emergence of structures and practices is what I just described, this ability, this idea that these systems for developing digital artifacts that people can then give away or not are now in use pretty universally across our institutions of higher education. That's too soon. And that one of the things we have to do is unlock those. But there's another one, too, because this is now the development of a community. It's the development of a community that can develop the software, that has meetings, that talks about itself on blogs, that works, you know, with different online communication systems, and that puts together certain legal structures so that it can operate. One of the legal structures for the Sakai community is the Sakai Foundation. That's what I work with, and it's there to protect the developers and to play, you know, to provide a home for the IP that is generated, and to provide some coordination activity for the community. Another one is this example of the response of this community recently, and the global response of the global community to an attack on the development of collaboration and learning environments, essentially, across the board by a patent that was given to an American company by the crazy United States Patent and Trademark Office. And it's one that is essentially distorting the market in the United States and is affecting markets all over the world. One of the nice things about open source software is it is in one sense, a hyper-capitalist invention. It's one of the ideas behind it is if we have perfect markets, if we allow those markets to operate, even in the development of the software and the adoption of the software by the users and the modifications of that software, that's a good thing. We don't want to distort markets like that. Markets are a good thing. They're coordination mechanisms that work, and they work in a distributed fashion. All that's good. So I've got a couple slides to talk about what is happening now that the Blackboard patent has been used, not only given to Blackboard, but is being used by Blackboard in an aggressive fashion. And aggressive fashion means that they're creating FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, around this question of the patent, and whether or not if you adopt another learning management system or virtual learning environment, whether or not you or your institution sometime in the future, it may not be too far, maybe never, but it may be tomorrow, right, will get sued. Right? So any CIO who runs into this kind of thing, who's trying to develop an enterprise system as a service, and I think one of the things that we need to look at when we think about all of this is not just what software have I got on my machine and what do I own, what can I use as a service? They hesitate, right? People are hesitating in rolling out some Sakai instances. People are at least hesitating in rolling out market offerings around Sakai, right? And we think that this will go away very quickly as the lawyers get all their ducks lined up and everybody gets the due diligence done and we essentially blast this patent out of the water. But the nice thing is that this has given us a wonderful opportunity for this global educational community to talk about another thing and to find places of common interest around a common enemy, right? Bad patents. Just the idea of this kind of patent being given in the first place, and Stephen's got a great blog on this, there's other places that great descriptions of this patent have popped up. This is something that we can talk about. We can talk about it with people that we would not necessarily be talking about things with. Others that we work with on various occasions, like Moodle, right? Or Desire to Learn, a proprietary software developer and company. And we work with them around this because this is something that we agree on, right? Patents used like this, patents in general. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of positions you can take on this. I'll take the lowest, the least controversial here. Patents like this shouldn't be used like this, right? They simply distort the market. Cut it out. So that's one of the things we're using. We're using our community to do these kinds of things. And you can read the slides all you want. We're to change patent law, and we're engaging in building super-organizational structures like the Software Freedom Law Center, which we've retained by the Sakai Foundation to go after these assholes, essentially. Just say, all right, here's the prior art. You've got the experience. This isn't something that we should be spending all our time on, right? Go get it. At the same time, we use this to educate our faculty who don't understand some of the fine points here. In fact, some don't understand some of the coarse points about patents and how they work and why they're not a good thing here. And we're able to mobilize some of the attributes of and some of the practices that have been developed by open source communities to go look at these patents. It may turn out that the vast majority of these kinds of patents are shallow in the same way that bugs are shallow if you have enough eyes to touch them. Right? And the development of places like Wikipedia, the noedupatents.com, the patentcommons.org, blogs for communication, all these are places that are developing prior art and giving us fora that we can investigate these kinds of patents and show people, hopefully at times, people in the patent office, that this is simply a bad thing to do. So there's, how much time?
10 minutes.
That's good enough. So you find all these nice things that have fallen out of this, right? And this is a case study in the emergence of structures and practices, collaborations and cooperation among the different members of open source and open educational resource community that is developing around the globe. Okay. So one of the things that we can point to is the emergence of means to move educational resources easily between our geographically rooted communities of scholars. That's what I'm calling it. Institutions of higher education today, and online communities. And here's an example, and this I'll blast through in 10 minutes. This is a Sakai OTW tool that was built essentially to make it easy for people to move their materials out from under the fair use umbrella, which is what they're using in the United States. I don't know what the situation is here, but in the United States we can, when I teach a class, use journal articles, chapters from books, up to a point, a lot of material that's copyrighted in my course, and I can put it up online for the people in my course to see, but I can't make it available to the world because that would be violating the copyright. Right? We call that working under a fair use umbrella. Is there an analog here? Right? Similar thing. So the problem with moving materials into an OTW environment, into an open environment, which is essentially a website that has all the materials that anybody in the world can go to, is you've got to clean up that IP. Right? You've got to get that intellectual property straight, and for the things that you can put up there, you do, or you find substitutes, or you find pointers to pre-publications of journal articles, or you just put up a citation. We built and the goal here is to build a tool that lets you do it. So Sakai, here's the Sakai plug. It's a community foundation product framework. It supports teaching and learning. It supports distributed research, too. This is one of the other streams of work to make it... that made it important from my perspective is support for scholarly activities in higher education. We want to make this possible for to support the same kinds of activities that faculty do, whether they're teaching or doing the other thing that they do at higher education institutions, which is their research. So while you'll see the same set of same kinds of tools up here, schedule, announcements, resources, discussion, all that stuff, you'll see a bunch of tools that are useful in building collaborations and research teams across sciences or, humanities or whatever. And since people are working with the same system, they can bring that research into the classroom and bring it all online. One thing about this, Just to reference the PLE discussion, is that one of the features of the tool is that anybody who's using it as a service can set up their own project. Students, faculty, whoever. We find administrators setting up projects so that they can do a survey of their services that they're providing for students or whatever, and working with three or four people together on that, right? And then discussing the results, doing a publication out of it, or setting up a web page and making it available to everybody. So they've personalized their environment for that. And a lot of people are using it. So the question is, how do we get all those materials out of Sakai and unlocked from the academy behind those walls and into an open source for content, an open educational resource environment to come? And the answer is, you build a tool. Hopefully a simple tool that allows people to handle the management, tag the categories so there's some similarity as people go to these different sites over what people call lecture notes or reading lists or syllabi or whatever, and make it easy for them to export it. So the faculty, I won't talk about this, so we started to build one. We're building it at the University of Michigan. I'm working on it. And it basically allows you to import a bunch of stuff from your resources or your tests or whatever, tag them, say, yes, I want to put those in the OCW site, say, this is the tag that I want on them, this is a schedule item, and here's the copyright I want associated with them. And the whole spectrum of Creative Commons copyrights are there. And this also, by the way, gives us a way to educate our faculty about copyright issues and introduce them to Creative Commons copyrights, as well as lots of others. And we take advantage, essentially, of the fact that the collaboration and learning environment, the educational infrastructure that the faculty are already using, and at the University of Michigan, we've got about 4,000, 5,000 faculty, about 3,000 are using the system. It's all voluntary there. All 40,000 students are using it. In fact, one of the drivers for adoption of this is the fact that students will go to faculty that aren't using it and say, why aren't you using this? I got up at 3 o'clock last night and tried to find my course materials, and you didn't have them up there. Right? What's the deal? And faculty then will get the idea and start to go and use it. But anyway, we have about 40,000 students who use it. So all that stuff is up there, and all those people have access to this, and all that material is there. And of course, they can modify it if they don't like the tags that we give them that came from MIT and a general OCW coalition now that's building over this. They can change them, and then they can publish them. Okay, and we started to do that. We've got the first ones that are coming through, and the materials are coming out there. So for these to be successful, we must have an open commons across the technologies and the content, and that's where we started, in my contention, that there's a convergence and a building of a global commons, both of the technologies and tools, and of the methods, and of the content that can be used. So, the future holds increasing interaction between institutional and individual initiatives in education and research, yada yada. We'll see progressive convergence between our more traditional homes of education, emerging means of learning. Incentive structures both online and in our knowledge institutions are being created. One of the things that MIT helped us with was building a set of incentive structures for the faculty to make their material public. Then as those feed back, as the faculty get the advantages of making their material open, they get it commented on, their colleagues see it. In some institutions, this is becoming part of their employment track, their promotion, a consideration in that area, that kind of thing. Pretty spooky idea for lots of institutions, right? Then that all feeds, is a positive feedback loop that leads into more material being put up and more value being created and more faculty getting involved. All this is based on the collaboration, like I said, made possible by the net and the new modes of production, see Stephen Weber again. And as lifelong learning really takes hold and as our institutions of higher education get locked into, as they must, this idea that there are values that they can, there's value that they can add to that, that not all learning will be self-learning, some learning will be directed learning, and in some places, people will, as I did say with sailing, I like to sail. I spent a lot of time when I first got into that looking at different sites on the net, saying, okay, here's what I can learn from that, and then I went to a sailing school, right? And then I sailed a lot, right? those kinds of things, and that cycle, that hybrid, those hybrid models of learning, discovery, creating, contributing, taking from, and building on, right, this idea of a commons, I think feeds into this whole model. So what we see emerging now are technologies to make this possible. RSS is certainly one of them, something that we're building into, have built into systems like Sakai and other services that provide tools for people and tools for learners and tools for enterprise level systems, systems like that. The community structures to support this are emerging. The legal structures to defend it are emerging because it's not easy to give stuff away. People yell at you. People take you to court,
yeah.
Right? People will bust you for giving away software. People will bust you for giving away content. And we have to have institutions like, in our case, the Kai Foundation, Software Freedom Law Center, and practices and knowledge among our faculty and users that this is simply something we have to support. It's part of the price that we pay to have a commons like this, to be able to give stuff away. And understanding, and a global self-understanding to help us move forward collectively so that we can all give a little and everybody can get a lot. So, let's look upon these systems as not just places where people do work or services that are provided that can be personalized, but also engines for educational resources. No matter how we feel, whatever position we take on learning objects and how much they can be contextualized or not. David, for instance, David Wiley, that was mentioned, was on a panel that I was on a few days ago, and one of his contentions is that the best context for learning objects quite often is a course that they've been given in. So the sequential arrangement, the material, supporting activities and supporting material around it are all there in one big piece. And people sometimes would find that the best place to go. So, thanks an awful lot. My name is down here, Joseph Harden, that's the email. And now we've got plenty of time to talk about plenty of stuff.
Joseph, thank you very much. I think there are a lot of sparks flying. Let's go from here and come back to the fireworks. Interesting combination of points of commerce and wonderful
All this talk about Weber.
I think caffeine will be dangerous.
I'm going to have a Yeah, because Thank you.
Question. Next question.
Hi, I'm Theo from a company called WT-Learn. And really, I think it's a question slash comment, and it feels like the whole debate is being positioned about one or the other. Why should it be one or the other? Shouldn't it be both at the same time? Because in my experience, it's really both approaches have relevant applications in relevant places. It's really about building a solution that can accommodate all of that. Blogging doesn't have any tracking, whereas formal learning needs tracking. Maybe just want to throw that into the mix, that it really shouldn't be a question of only this or that. It should really be a question of having a solution that's inclusive.
Can we have it all across many systems, possibly within one system? I think something's going to also provoke a bit more debate. One more question, then we'll possibly get some responses. Okay. Perhaps brief responses from Joseph and Stephen.
Librarians, absolutely. One of the strengths, of course, one of the defining features of the academy is the library. It's been the foundation that universities have been built on in the past. And while it is in the process of transformation under the force and the possibilities that have been opened up by a lot of the technologies that we've described, a lot of the specialized functions and a lot of the activities, especially of librarians themselves, are, still will forever be central to the learning process, especially any kind of learning process that's going into a specialized field. In the work that we do in the Sakai community, there are a number of projects underway. One of them is the Sakai-Brary project. It's trying to make it easy for faculty to connect their teaching site to library resources, whether it's pointing to texts that are in the library. We have a term called electronic reserves. I don't know if it's the same here, but sometimes it's difficult for faculty to either know what they can do with it, get access to it, or make that material easily available to their students. And so the Sakai Brary Project's working, and it's a bunch of librarians, of course, that are doing it. They're the ones that are coming up with the use cases and working with the faculty and students and working with the software developers and actually building the tools. So I couldn't agree with that comment anymore. The question about
scaffolding learning.
You bet. There's just so many different ways that people learn, and there's so many different types of learner that figuring out what the best scaffolding, what the best foundations, and what the best steps are for people to go through, and is one that I don't want to take on. What I want to do is enable all the different types of learning that people want. So if it's constructivist, fine. Here's a set of tools that will let you do that easily. If it's straight, proscenium style teaching that you think has worked for you and your students have told you has in the past, and that's what you're going to do here, this might facilitate that and make some parts of it better and might allow for more interaction. If it's case-based learning, here's a set of tools. If it's case-based learning in law versus medicine versus whatever, and those are all different styles, right? They're all specific in the way that they approach a case and the things they look for, and that should be supported. I'm not sure what was meant by the lack of human capital and how it fit in with the earlier comments. Maybe you could elucidate that.
I was just saying that the assumption is that the teachers are going to be able to interpret these tools, use them appropriately, match them to the problems and so on.
Right. No, that's, yes, that's something we have to work on. And by that I don't mean that that's something we can't do right now. I mean it's part of the work. We do know how to introduce teachers to these. We do know in all kinds of contexts. And there's a number of projects here going on by the Mweka Institute and the African Virtual University, as well as traditional universities here at Cape Town, UNISA, the Distance Learning School, and others, NYU, places that are working with Sakai, and places that are working with teaching teachers. Right? And certainly this is something that, we have to work on. And one of the things that was that I think about when I think about a system like this is, how do you present it to somebody for the first time? How simple can you make it? And then how can you progressively disclose all the features and the variety of ways that somebody could enter into it? So if it's the first introduction is that somebody uses it to stick up a syllabus and put two papers that the students are going to read in the class there, okay, right, that's a good start. That gets them thinking about it, and maybe it gets them over fear of clicking. And if that's what it takes, then that's the route. And then you need to have the support infrastructure, and part of that support infrastructure at our university is provided by their colleagues who have already started to use it. Once you get over a certain critical mass, so this is the kind of thing that, like any web phenomenon, people help each other a lot and work with it. But yeah, that's something that I think you need to think about too. And the last point about can't we have both, I thought that's what I was saying. Right? That's what I meant to say. If I didn't say it, these are technologies and practices, some emergent, some traditional, some hybrids of both, that we can use in all kinds of contexts. And we should. And you shouldn't rely on one or the other. You should be able to move freely and easily as individuals, and institutions should make it easy for that movement. And increasingly, they're doing
it. It's an interesting set of questions. And you did draw, because all three of them were on the same theme, different aspects, but on the same theme. And it drew the distinction, the difference in starting points between the two of us, where he's starting from the institutional point of view, and I'm starting from what I would describe as the learner point of view. Indeed, even I seize on a couple of remarks that he made during the talk, talking about new means of production. And, I'm an old hand at Marxist theology.
You know the term is new mode of production.
But I'm speaking off the top of my head with dyslexia, so you have to give me a break. And to me, the relevant Marxist adage here is ownership of the means of production. And you see the distinction, right? The institutional focus, the ownership of the means of production, remains in the hands of the institution. But post-Web 2.0, the ownership of the means of production is in the hands of the people, or in this case, the learner. Open source software as promoting free markets and enterprise, the victory of capitalism. I look at open source software and I see to each according to his needs, from each according to his abilities. So, depending on where you are, what perspective you are, you see exactly the same thing very differently. And that's what's happening here. The question of libraries. What is a library? Right? On one hand, it's a place where you put all your books. But if that's the model, and every time I get that picture of a library, right, I think of the Library of Alexandria and the disaster that happened when it was burned in the 4th century. Right? One thing we have learned since then is don't put all your books in one place. Okay? And the internet allows us to put all of the books in multiple places. If the model is you put your books in a library, that's the institutional way of thinking. But if the model is the books are distributed wherever they're wanted, wherever they're needed, so we have not just multiple copies, but hundreds of copies, hundreds of thousands of copies, and the books aren't just static objects, but they're things that change, that move, that evolve, that are dynamic. If they're not simply static texts, but the vocabulary of a conversation, then your model of a library is something very different. And a library isn't just some place you store objects, but a library rather consists of a set of services and a set of approaches, things like resource location, categorization, bibliographic, all of the resources and services that a library offers other than books. Because we can't depend on having places to store objects anymore. And then it becomes the question of ownership. Who owns this process? Who owns the resource? Does the library own the resource? Does the publisher own the resource? Or does it belong, the means of production, as according to their need, to the learner? Scaffolding, same sort of thing. Who's in charge? Right? Scaffolding means one thing from the perspective of the teachers, that, you know, the process that I'm going to take to step somebody through the learning so that they move up to more and more complex and more independent action. From the point of view of the learner, though, it's the supports and the props and the struts that they need in order to do what they want to do. Scaffolding might be an instructional design imposed on a class by a teacher as the way we're going to do this course, or it might be a feature or property of a piece of software or application that was selected by a user. You see the difference? Scaffolding doesn't go away, but what happens is there needs to be an understanding of who chooses when it's applied, who chooses how it's applied. One or the other. You know, and this is the point that I always stick on, right? And how to express that. I see this, you know, because I hear this a lot. To me, it's sort of like, good, the people are winning because the institutions are ready to compromise. But in my mind, okay, and I'll express it the extreme way and then back off on the point, because the extreme way will elucidate it. It's like finding the middle point between a democracy and a dictatorship. And how do you do that? How do you find the middle point between you determine your own future and somebody does it for you? Right? There isn't a middle point in questions of ownership of oneself and empowerment of the individual. There just isn't that middle point. The minute you take control of any aspect of my life, the minute you take it, I've lost my freedom. Even if it's just a little bit, I've lost my freedom. So, that doesn't mean there's no institutions. It doesn't mean there's no structure, that there's no libraries, that there's no classes or anything like that. It doesn't mean these things go away. They exist because they have utility. And we have classes for 2,000 years because they actually work. But the difference is who chooses them. The difference is, well, to me the difference is, can I get up and walk out without any consequences? Right? Anybody here, do you think this is a bad talk? Get up and go. No, you know, you're not going to lose any grades. Right? You're not going to miss something that's on the test. That's the difference. Now, what's the compromise between that freedom and you do lose a grade? You do get penalized on an exam. You do fail to get your degree. Where's the middle point? So, I don't recognize a middle point. I think that learning must unequivocally be in the hands of the learner. And that people who are in the business of providing a learning have to change their attitude from we provide a service for you to we help you do it for yourself. And I really see no halfway in between that.
It's very clear then that we have two somewhat opposed perspectives, with Joseph working within a liberal discourse and Stephen very differently within a radical discourse, no compromise. There is no middle ground. And I think perhaps this might provoke some other questions.
I'll go back with this. I mean, I think people do give up freedoms in extent. Sorry, Stephen Marquardt from University of Cape Town. people do give up freedoms in exchange for certain shared values, for example. In South Africa, we have a constitution and you spoke of the wisdom of crowds, and the wisdom of crowds in South Africa right now might be in favor of the death penalty and the constitution is not. So there are enduring institutions and structures which are created willingly by individuals where people surrender some freedoms to an authority structure. But I throw that in the comments. I really wanted to pick up the question about ownership of the modes of production, because we talked about, as an individual, if your institution owns it, you don't own it. But you don't own it if you're using Google and Blogger. You're at the mercy of their terms of service as corporate entities in the US. And we've seen what patents and share price do to corporate behavior in the US. So we're really between, you know, the devil and the deep blue sea. And Flickr is not open source either. So their terms of service change and they won't give you your photos back and then you suck. Your institution might be acting in a very Web 1.0 way. It owns all your data, or it might be acting in a very empowering way that is giving students access to means of production that they don't otherwise have. And in South Africa, there are also issues like access to bandwidth and speed, for example, that make local services in some cases faster and preferable than US-based services.
Okay, let's take one or two other questions. The comments before we get responses from Joseph and Stephen. No one else was provoked by the last round?
They're all too polite. They're going to walk out.
Okay, I'm going to urge you to sacrifice your politeness temporarily.
Oh, you had a question.
Mike Charles from the Western Cape Education Department. On Thursday last week, the Philadelphia School District, and with the help of Billy Gates, opened a School of the Future. What would your views be on what a school of the future would look like in anywhere in the world?
Okay, great question. Worthy of a dissertation. And one more question or comment before we hand back to Joseph and Stephen. No? Okay, back to the two of you.
Who's up?
I'll go. Because you went for a five minutes. Because I have things I want to say. To the first point, and I try to draw this up, and I need a good story. And it's one of these things I don't have a story for yet. There's a real big difference between giving up a freedom and losing a freedom. When I visit a new city, right, I can put my hands, or I can put myself in the hands of a trained guide who will take me from place to place to place. And, you know, and I can get into that person's car and we drive around. I'm not really free to just jump out of the car anymore because, you know, there'd be all kinds of bad consequences if I do that, including death and dismemberment. Not necessarily in that order. But I can give up that freedom, right? But it's my choice whether or not to get in that car. That's very different from being kidnapped and shown around the city by kidnappers. Say, you will look at this, you will look at this. The school system currently resembles kidnapping much more than it resembles touring. Okay, that's badly put, but you know what I mean. The school of the future, there was, I was trying to shade into. Like, and you talked about, the Flickr's not open and all that, it's proprietary, they can change the terms of service. How many of you currently use a product called Movable Type? Right. Movable Type is what came before WordPress. Movable Type's been around as long as Blogger has been around, as long as LiveJournal has been around. Movable Type was proprietary software, and you had to sign terms of service, and one day, about two and a half, maybe three years ago, they decided to raise their prices dramatically, and their user community, first of all, rebelled, secondly, closed all of their blogs, and thirdly, built their own blogging system that we know of as WordPress now. So Yahoo attempted to assert ownership of all contents of Yahoo discussion groups and was hit with a similar user rebellion. When there is choice, when you can get up and walk away or build your own thing, the power doesn't exist anymore to simply impose the terms.
right now in school, schooling is mandatory, in Canada at least, and in many other countries, for people under a certain age. You will go to school, period. And it's mandatory in the sense that if you don't have a degree from an officially recognized institution, it's very difficult to get a job and proper employment. So, you know, again, you don't have the freedom to just get up and walk away. What is the school of the future? No school. And that's not the 5 years from now, or more accurately, a de-school of society, if you will, just to pull the phrase out. Let all the associations come tumbling down. I see schooling as something that happens while you're in the process of leading your life and doing the things that you want to do. Schooling is something that happens, or learning more accurately, is something that happens while you're pursuing your interest in forestry, or in fishing, or in architecture, or in art. Or whatever it is that you like to do. Because people will do things. The evidence is overwhelming that people, given the freedom and given the resources, will do things. All people will do things. Right? The fear is always, well, if you give them their freedom, they'll just hang around and not do anything and be lazy. I see no evidence of that. In fact, I see exactly the contrary. Every time a people has the resources and has the freedom, a flowering of creativity happens, and people teach themselves, and they grab these resources because they have the freedom to get up and go. And that is the difference. And that's why I talk about Web 2.0 and free resources and all of that, because that is the mechanism that enables that kind of system. You know, and we have so much in common, Joseph and I, in our approaches, our attitudes, the belief in open source and all of that. And, I give Sakai a lot of my time because I think it's absolutely worth it. But there is the big difference, I think, really is the institutional versus the individual. And in the long run, I mean, I think we're going through a paradigm shift. I think we're going through a global revolution from the age of the institution to the age of the empowered individual. And I think that the key catalyst for this is the creation of the internet, which puts the means of communications, the means of creativity, the means of production into the hands of everybody, genuinely.
Stephen, thank you very much for that. For later conversation, I think there's the issue of where is the role of the community in between the institution and the individual. I would like to now hand over to Joseph.
Golly.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, the level of I don't know exactly where to start on questions of educational philosophy like this. These are all moody blues questions to me. It's a question of balance. If you look at what is the role of an organization, which we could call an institution, or what is the role of empowered individuals, I think there's many different balance points, and to make large statements about them probably just builds divides that in practice we would simply not even recognize we're there. Certainly, the educational system needs reform. It always does. Higher education is, in many cases, a choice. A couple of my sons just made the choice to do that, or have just recently. And there were lots of pressures, sure. But I don't think that's a distinctive, defining difference between the ways that they have, the options that they have open to them. As far as education goes, I don't know what a school of the future is, but I think it's a school. I think that it's probably a lot of different schools and a lot of different ways of going about this. It's not the current schools, though it'll have a lot of their features. There will be physically located communities of scholars and students, and they'll engage in discussion and research. and they'll be increasingly empowered to expand those discussions in virtual environments. But I think that we are also embodied human beings. There are a lot of damn good reasons that I'd like to see somebody go through the socialization process of going to a community of scholars. I don't think this is all a question of self-learning. I think selves are things that are socially constructed. And they are things that need and like social interactions and social communities to help them with that construction. So I don't know anything about the Bill Gates school. Anything, of course, that has Gates associated with it is first order scary. But at the same time, as we are seeing, there's, you know, Bill is doing a lot of good stuff in a lot of places. I mean, places like this, places all over the world. I saw a magazine cover. Fortune magazine has Bill Clinton on the cover in the newsstand, at least in some airport. I can't remember which one it was. And it talks about Bill being the catalyst to get Bill Clinton, to get Bill Gates and that other rich guy to give $30 billion apiece, right, for philanthropy. And this whole new mode of digging in and plowing back in some of these monopoly profits that have been made. So I don't know what Bill has in mind. I'm sure it's checked out. And I'm sure that is probably, you know, has a lot of flash associated with it. I used to work at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. That's the place. I was the head of the software development group there. It's the place that the first, one of the first browsers came out of, the Mosaic browser. And we had lots of flash. And it was part of the job. It was part of the process of introducing to people what could potentially happen, right? What if you had unlimited bandwidth and you could walk into a room that you could be in 3D virtual presence with somebody in San Francisco? That's cool. I mean, that's interesting, and it's exciting, and it raises possibilities and stuff. But that's my experience. Has been that it'll be a long time before we get all of the socio-technical things right, so that some of that happens. It will be a long time until we get all the infrastructure in place. And in the meantime, a lot of the kinds of activities that we simply proceed with our work on in day-to-day and use virtual means to help us with are the things that we will use in our schooling in the future. I don't think that institutions are places that are set up to kidnap. I'm sure there's kidnapping videos on it. I remember my organic chemistry class well enough. But at the same time, I liked that stuff, right? And I got beat up, but there was, I don't know another way that I would have gone through figuring out what a but some of the things that we're in.
Benign kidnapping?
No, I don't think it was kidnapping. I think
there's a big difference between organic chemistry as a requirement and organic chemistry as an option.
Well, it depends on what your major was. At the time it was pre-med, so it was a requirement, but I'd chosen to be pre-med.
I was in philosophy. It was very much an option. I still did it, though. I like organic chemistry. It's cool. Oh, carbon element. Community of practice, totally agree. I want to rephrase something you said by making some minor substitutions. Substitutions so minor that the words are practically the same in meaning. You said, and I quote, "I'd like to see somebody going through the socialization process. Selves are socially constructed." Okay.
or actually you said selves are constructed by society.
No, I said social
construction.
I was thinking of social construction. Yeah.
Right, okay. I'd like to see somebody going through the indoctrination process. Selves are constructed by the state. Subtle, right?
Not subtle.
when you say, I'd like to see somebody go through, like, you say, I want these other people to behave in such and such a way, and I will make them go through this socialization process, and I say, what gives you the right?
I didn't say make, you said lack.
Yeah, but what you'd like to do is make people go through this. Other person, Warren Buffett.
That's the other $30 billion guy.
Speaking of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, you like seeing them collectively give $30 billion to aid research and education and all of that, but Bill Gates' company is the company that in the 1990s prevented the shipment of free computers to Papua New Guinea because they had copies of Windows 3.1 on them. Now, the current Windows at the time was Windows Millennium Edition, and nobody was using 3.1, but the Australian aid agency that was moving these computers to New Guinea had to remove Windows 3.1 from all of these computers, and basically the project pretty much collapsed. You have to ask, where did the $30 billion come from, and was the net benefit of what Gates did, including his philanthropy, better as a result of Bill Gates? It's not, you love to idolize the guy who got rich, but it's kind of like thanking the pirate for the benevolence.
I don't think we're going to achieve a satisfactory cost-benefit analysis of the existence of Bill Gates as a social phenomenon. And I think that we're getting close to, in fact, we're exceeding closing time for the meeting. So I'd like to ask Joseph if he wants to say anything else that will either ratchet up the differences or enhance possibilities for the dialogue.
No, I think there's an awful lot of commonality here, as you can tell. And the attempt to find, like, serious divides here, I think takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of work to figure out what the right wedge is in something like this. And I seldom am I referred to as a liberal. So thank you very much. I'll tell my dean.
Right.
I'll tell my dean about that. But there was a very strong truth in what you said. And a lot of that has to do with I'd like to figure out how we can move from what we have now. In other words, what the starting points are that we have now and how we can leverage the resources in both the emerging technologies and communities and the existing, especially scholarly communities of teaching, learning, and research, and build a better future. Right? So, liberal figure, I'd rather think of it as anarcho-syndicalist, but that's
Well, I certainly hope that both of you choose freely to continue this conversation during the duration of your shared stay in Cape Town, and thank you very much to both of you for stimulation and challenge.
Can I have
thank
one
you.
Closing remark? I thought you were going to give me a closing remark. And that's definitely not allocating according to their needs. I just want to be clear that I highlighted and drawn up the 5% of differences between us rather than emphasizing the 95% of similarities in what we believe and what we're working towards. So I do want to take the last remark to say that I think that we're very much on the same page, and the differences aren't as extreme, and that they were drawn out, and in my case, drawn out to make the point that I think that the most important part of this whole internet thing, geez, I'm like that guy that's a series of twos, is the possibility for empowerment
for personal empowerment and personal self-development that is now enabled. And to me, that's the thing that makes the internet special.
Thank you very much.
I could actually swing by on the way to Marco's, like a drop Stephen Ann or Scotia. I'm not the same as the offering.
Okay, well, you and me,
where are you going to take this? Are they going down or are they going up?
We will take our pride together. We will fly so high that all our plans collide. We will sound like you. This is what weather will be. The weather
Thank you.
And now I can shut it down.
If you hadn't told me, I would have had a small heart attack.
What happened?
No, I've gone and I didn't know Roger had that camera. I've gone and grabbed the other one. I need to cover it. Didn't have.
You're probably right. But you need your swap file. You need your swap file. Yeah, because you haven't added anything. And I'm back down
to that doesn't make sense.
I had a great time.
Good. It's funny when an anarcho-syndicalist means a libertarian, the anarcho-syndicalist sounds liberal.
Now I know why I'm down to 100.